from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, how reliable is eyewitness testimony? Research indicates it's a lot less reliable than most people think because memory is much more fragile and unreliable than we are led to believe. And time-worn methods of determining guilt by facial identification are demonstrably and seriously flawed. We'll take up the issue in the hour ahead. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last week, the New Jersey Supreme Court reformed the use of evidence from police lineups for use by judges and juries. In the ruling, the court supported research that traditional eyewitness identification procedures are flawed and can send innocent men and women to prison. By allowing defendants to challenge witness evidence in criminal cases, the court decision now allows for investigators who fail to take steps to reduce subtle pressures and influence on witnesses that can result in mistaken identification. Other courts are likely to follow, and the U.S. Supreme Court will take up the question of identification for the first time since 1977. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we discuss the reliability and procedures involved in eyewitness identification as well as reforms. Let me introduce our guest to you. Gary Wells is with us. He is a professor of psychology at Iowa State University who has been working in this field for about over 30 years now. And Professor Wells, good to have you with us. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you. We also have Karen Sinanu-Towery, who's Assistant District Attorney at Santa Clara County and joins us from the South Bay this morning. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And we also have Robert Weisberg from down in the South Bay. He's Professor of Law at Stanford and co-directs Stanford's Criminal Justice Center at the Stanford Law School. Welcome, Robert Weisberg.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let me begin, if I may, Professor Weisberg, with you, and let's just talk about this New Jersey case and also North Carolina and what it means in terms of, real reform. I mentioned North Carolina because that also is a state where some of these real serious kinds of reforms have taken place. How do they differ from what we've seen in the past and what we think of as TV lineups and all of that sort of thing?
The New Jersey Supreme Court handed down a very bold decision. I should emphasize that it was interpreting its own state constitution, so the decision does not itself involve the federal constitution, but it may inspire other states. The gist of it is to take extremely seriously the scientific research performed by our guest Dr. Wells and others about the steps that have to be taken to reduce the dangers of misleadingly suggestive and unreliable lineups. It makes it much easier for a defendant to win a pretrial hearing opportunity on a lineup to try to persuade a judge that there were things involving the structuring of either a live lineup or a photo array that were very impermissibly suggestive, and that there were other factors about the perspective of the eyewitness that render the person's out-of-court ID unreliable. And imposes pretty strict rules on the judges to screen possible IDs so that it isn't left to a defense lawyer to try to persuade a jury that a questionable ID is questionable. Rather, it makes it much easier for a defense lawyer to convince the judge to not allow the identification to come to the jury in the first place.
This also ties in with the idea that, somebody ought to be administering, let's say, the showing of photos and administering them singly as opposed to just laying down a bunch of photos, that's more effective in terms of people's memories or connecting with people's memories and not to have a primary investigator, not to have someone, in other words, who's involved in the case.
Sure. I mean, those are some of the key criteria. Dr. Wells can obviously talk about others, but it's very important that the witness not be given the impression that in any particular batch of photos or in a lineup, he or she should assume that the perpetrator is there. And there should be no suggestions or cues on the part of the investigator that that might be the one, or it's probably one of this group. And indeed, one way to prevent that is to have a kind of blinding, in the sense that the person performing the procedure was not the investigator and may himself not know, which the most viable suspect is.
Again, Robert Weisberg is professor of law at Stanford and co-directs the Stanford Criminal Justice Center. And Gary Wells is professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and as I said, has been working in this field for well over three decades now. The real key to some of this concern that we're seeing, as well as the case in New Jersey and what's happened in North Carolina, what may be happening throughout the United States, is just the overall unreliability of this kind of memory and identification, Professor Wells. And let me ask you to address that. What we know now pretty much gives, well, credence to the idea that the memory is just not as reliable as we think it is.
Well, that's right. We have a number of ways of knowing this now. When I began this work over 30 years ago, and we still do this, we tried to build a science based on creating events for unsuspecting people, followed by lineups to study errors. We still do that. That's the primary source of how we know how to improve eyewitness identification and how we know things about the power of suggestion. For a long time, I mean, I was doing this work for 20 years and publishing this work based on what are commonly referred to as lab studies, and psychological science was kind of blowing the whistle on this evidence, saying, hey, there's a, there's a problem here. We have to be careful. But then what came along was forensic DNA testing in the 90s, and then it got used to test claims of innocence, and it turns out that three out of every four DNA exonerations are cases of mistaken eyewitness identification. In more recent times, what we've done is looked at sort of every lineup that is done in certain police departments. We just finished a big study of this where we want to know, okay, given that a lineup was shown, photographic lineup, for example, how often does a witness pick what we call filler, that is a known innocent person, versus the suspect who may or may not be guilty? And it turns out about a third of the time, witnesses to serious crimes in real cases pick a filler. So that tells us something very important, I think, about reliability issues in eyewitness identification.
Also tells us that lineups, and of course, like many people who think of the old television show, The Lineup, those are becoming more a part of the past, that lineups, if they're to go on, or any kind of photographic display, ought to, the person who's identifying ought to be told there may not be a defendant or a possible defendant in the lineup, right?
Absolutely. It's critical, and this was some of our earliest experiments, that the real perpetrator might not be there. Because if you look at where things go wrong, where things really go wrong is when the real perpetrator's not in the lineup at all. The police think, oh, maybe Joe did it. They put together a lineup with Joe in there, but in fact, Joe didn't do it. The real perp is still at large. Witnesses still have a propensity to select someone. So we have to make them sensitive to the idea that the correct answer may be none of the above.
With all of these tests and all this research, over 2,000 scientific studies, for example, and working on DNA executions or slated executions, and realizing that the people should not be, in fact, have not been found guilty. Nevertheless, we need eyewitness testimony. So,
absolutely.
So we're talking about the necessity for reforms here that can make eyewitness testimony as reliable or as efficient as possible.
Well, that's right. I mean, when we were first doing these experiments and finding such, there were those who looked at that work and said, hey, we should stop relying on eyewitness identification. We cannot stop relying on eyewitness identification. It's a very critical type of evidence. We have to have a way to put perpetrators away. So we have to find ways to improve the reliability of that evidence. And that's what this is all about.
It's also, I think, from your research, recognizable that the memory works very rapidly. If there is recognition, it usually happens with a kind of rapidity that most people don't realize. And yet this whole process of looking at photographs and so forth is much more of a kind of mulling, ruminative process.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is a very reliable finding, and it makes sense based on what we know about how memory works. Recognition memory, which is the type of memory we're talking about here, is a very rapid and what we call automatic process. It's largely effortless. A witness ought to be able to look at a lineup and be able to quickly, the real person ought to pop out if they're able to make an identification. The problem is that, you know, occurs when that does not happen, and instead the witness starts mulling things over. Well, you know, it could be one. It's not two. It's not five. Three looks more like him than anybody else, so I'm going to pick three. That kind of process is not a reliable process. So if it does not happen quickly, then chances are the witness is using something that we call secondary processes, things other than true recognition memory, and that's where problems occur.
Gary Wells, professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Catherine Sinanou-Towery is also with us. She's an assistant district attorney at Santa Clara County. And Karen Sinanou-Towery, there's been resistance to some of these reforms we're talking about. A lot of police don't like it. Some do, but a lot don't. In fact, resent the fact that maybe their integrity is being questioned. And in fact, in many instances, saying that they've been too suggestible to affect witnesses and that sort of thing. But also, DAs don't seem to like these kinds of reforms. Let's get your perspective on it. I mean, the reforms seem necessary to you, don't they?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say generally some prosecutors don't like these reforms and some welcome them. And in Santa Clara County, we welcome this decision. We have been very concerned about faulty eyewitness identification. And in 2002, we developed a lineup protocol that all of our law enforcement agencies here in the South Bay signed on to. And many of the factors discussed in the New Jersey case we embraced in 2002. We have a mandated sequential lineup here, whether it's live or by photographs.
That's one is one at a time as opposed to the so-called six-pack where you just lay things
exactly.
down.
Exactly. And it's our belief that a witness will do better comparing one photo at a time to their memory rather than being presented with six pictures at one time where the person tends to compare one person to another. But we also prefer the double-blind system where the officer showing the photographs or the individual has no idea who the suspect is and who the fillers are. Now, we also give admonitions that the person may or may not be in the lineup being shown. So in Santa Clara County, we welcome this sort of approach to being as scientific and as fair-minded as possible when presenting a witness with a lineup. And the system variables and estimator variables discussed in the case are important ones. But I'll tell you a problem I ran into last year that very much surprised me and makes me believe we need to go even further here in the South Bay. We had a case with a show-up, and that's where an officer is able to apprehend a suspect within 10 or 15 minutes of the crime. And the suspect was pulled over by the police, and then the victim, and it had been an on-the-street robbery, was brought to where the suspect was and asked, is this the person? And when I read the police report, everything looked perfect. He had been admonished, this may or may not be the person. But the officer at the time had a recording on her body. And it was recording what she said to the witness. And what she said to the witness is, he has a different shirt on now, referring to the suspect. Well, that's telling the witness that the person they've stopped on the street is the person, and they've simply changed their clothes. And she also said, now, I don't want you to be afraid before I show you this person. So those two indicators, to me, were very suggestive. And I never would have known about that from reading the police report. It just happened that she was being recorded. So I think we really need to look at videotaping officers and witnesses when we're showing any kind of lineup, live or photographic.
It's going to be more expensive if you do that, isn't it?
It's going to be more expensive, but what's more expensive, having the innocent suffer or, you know, taking an extra half hour?
It's not only innocent suffering. If you have the wrong person, then you've got someone out there on the street who's still perpetrator, right?
Yeah.
And maybe doing more perpetrating. I'm wondering what your reaction is to a big question that looms in this whole topic and discussion we're having. There was an article, in fact, about it, Mother Jones. They talked about the things that interfere with good identification. For example, like in the event you just described, sometimes things happen so fast and there's a lot of tension, a lot of adrenaline, but there can be bad light. Things can happen far away. But they also talk about the difficulty of cross-racial identification. And a lot of the research shows that people who are of one ethnic group have much more difficulty with people of another ethnic group. And so what do you do down there in Santa Clara to diminish that kind of concern?
Well, we have such a multicultural community down here and very diverse. There is, as a matter of fact, there's no majority race in Santa Clara County. So there's nothing, I mean, those are the facts we deal with, but our jurors certainly are given an instruction that this is one factor they can consider. And in the process for pre-litigation determination as to whether or not a lineup is suggestive, this is one of the estimator variables that the New Jersey case discussed. And I think it's an important one to consider whether or not, because on its face, it's not just that I'm Caucasian and I may not be able to identify a Vietnamese person as well. It may also, you have to look further and go, well, how many Vietnamese people do you know? Have you been to Vietnam? Are you married to someone Vietnamese? I mean, it's not just on its face, your races are different, but what? How familiar are you with the other race?
Again, Karen Sinanu-Towery is Assistant District Attorney of Santa Clara County. We should mention, since you mentioned videos, in the UK, that is the preferred way of doing things now, and the non-investigative administrator, in some instances, just a laptop, just auditory for police lineups. Let me go back, Professor Weisberg, to you. These new kind of guidelines that we're talking about that are coming out of New Jersey and that are in place in North Carolina and places like the UK. Talk about the legal challenges of implementing these, because there are many.
They very much complicate trials because they impose a lot of burdens on trial judges to conduct extremely extensive hearings. The New Jersey opinion has already been subject to a fair amount of criticism because while it mandates that scientific research be implemented through, you know, what Karen referred to as the estimator and system variables, well, they impose a lot of intellectual challenges at the very least on the judges. You know, it's been said that the judges have to, you know, become social science experts to run through all these variables and then come up with some kind of very tentative conclusion about whether the ID could go forward. In addition, and this is the other main ruling coming out of New Jersey, is that the judge has to give very, very detailed instructions to the jurors about the criteria they should apply in determining whether, if they hear an ID, they should believe it. And so it's a kind of double translation problem of the science into the judge's thinking and then the judge's analysis into the jury's thinking. And in fact, the short-term result of the New Jersey ruling was that the state Supreme Court told a state judicial commission that it had to generate model instructions. So we don't even know what those are going to be.
Isn't it generally true that a lot of jurors will simply say, this person's identified someone as a suspect, they're the victim, they have no reason to lie, and so they become even more credible in a juror's mind?
Oh, that's certainly a tendency, but a major factor here is going to be the skill of the defense lawyer, but also the information that the defense lawyer has available, because obviously a cross-examination of a witness, you know, can be very effective. Isn't it true that when you first picked out this, my client, you know, he was in a lineup, you know, with five people who looked entirely different. Did the police officer say anything to you, and so on and so on? And it's not just the witness to the crime who might be on the stand, but, you know, a police officer who was playing some kind of role in the ID procedure. So that you can have plenty of cross-examination, which could persuade the jury to disbelieve an ID. But again, the effect of the of decisions like the one in New Jersey is to keep a lot of these IDs from getting to the jury in the first place, because, you know, it's hard to predict whether a defense lawyer will have the skill or the information to really undo the effect of an ID.
Well, in fact, Gary Wells, a lot of the research seems to indicate that when people are certain in their own minds and confident, and we happen to see the piece of, that you were on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl, in fact, she got a suspect wrong,
right.
They become quite confident and sure of themselves, don't they?
Well, that's right. You know, the one of the biggest problems that we have, really, is that generally speaking, sort of no matter how effective the defense attorney might be in launching various of the arguments that that Robert was pointing out, if the witness is certain, it just seems to trump most everything else. Now, one of the problems and one of the very interesting and most reliable phenomenon that we've documented is that witness certainty is malleable. So what happens is, in our experiments, for example, a witness who makes a mistaken identification, if all we do is just simply do a little quick, what we call feedback, confirming feedback, even though the witness was mistaken, you know, we would say something like, "Oh, good, you identified the suspect in the case." Then what happens later is when you ask them, "How certain were you at the time you made your identification?" They misremember it. They think they were certain all along. So what happens is certainty is malleable, it grows. By the time they get to trial, they're positive. So a lot of these things are taken care of. Actually, if you go ahead and use the procedures that are now in place in New Jersey, in North Carolina, and some other places, including, I believe, Santa Clara, California and County, which, by the way, is very progressive and has been for quite some time on these issues, and that is that you use a double-blind procedure. That is, the person who administers this lineup or photo spread does not know which person is the suspect and which ones are fillers. And then if the witness makes an identification, that they are asked at that point in time, how certain are you? And that's a matter of record. So that if their certainty grows over time or whatever, it's clearly not a reflection of how good their memory was. It's a reflection of other things that have happened, or, you know, the way in which certainty just naturally inflates.
And again, Gary Wells with us from Iowa State this morning is professor of psychology at Iowa State University and a leading researcher in this field. I'm going to open the phone lines, invite those of you listening to join us. If you have questions or comments or would like to join our conversation, you can do that now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. Again, the number to call, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Last week, the New Jersey Supreme Court made it easier for defendants to challenge eyewitness testimony on the grounds that it may be flawed. Research shows that about one-third of the witnesses who pick out suspects choose the wrong person. We're looking at recommendations for eyewitness testimony protocol in this hour and finding out about some of the reforms that are already in the works here in California. Robert Weisberg is with us, professor of law at Stanford and co-director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center, and Gary Wells, professor of psychology at Iowa State, and Karen Sinanu-Towery, who is assistant district attorney at Santa Clara County. Our toll-free number, should you want to join the conversation, and we invite you to do that, is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post your response, question, or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm going to go to your calls and emails and web postings here forthwith. I wanted to just go back to Assistant District Attorney Sinanu-Towery for a moment. We heard, actually, Gary Wells, before we went to the break, Karen Sinanu-Towery, talk about how in Santa Clara things have been really quite progressive. And I wanted to just get more detail from you. I think you've given a very good sort of portal view of what is going on and the changes that have been made. But I'd like you to maybe give some more detail about what you've done there that really fits the category of more progressive.
Well, we are very proud of this, and it's part of our conviction integrity unit. And we want to make sure that we are doing the best practices. And as this decision shows, there's always room for improvement. But in 2002, we set out a protocol that is about 5 pages that officers need to follow when giving a photo or live lineup in Santa Clara County. And the witness is admonished first, and they are the witness is told that the person may or may not be contained within the lineup. The witness has to state in his or her own words how certain they are of the identification, and the officer is supposed to note that level of certainty. The photos will be viewed, or the people will be viewed one at a time, so that the witness will be comparing their memory to the visual of the suspect and fillers. There will only be one picture of the suspect and 5 fillers. So in other words, you don't have 2 pictures of the suspect and 3 fillers. The witness can ask to see the photos or persons again. They can take as much time as they want. The witness has to explain that they understand the procedure, and all this has to be documented. But we don't yet have here either a recording or a videotaping of it. And after my experience last year, I think we might need to take that additional step, because what the court has to do is decide whether or not this was a good identification, whether it was overly suggestive. And the courts do that now with confessions. They have to make a determination of whether or not a confession is voluntary. And how they usually do that is by listening to it or reviewing the videotape of that confession.
I thank you for that. And let me bring in our callers. In fact, let's go to a caller in San Jose. Sally, join us, please. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm conflicted by this program. In the late 70s, I was picked up by a pedophile, and he was caught and put behind bars. The most traumatic part to me at the time was not the event itself, but was the lineup. And the reason was because I had to sign a document that said I was 100% positive this was the person. And I was 12 at the time, and I wasn't positive. And it took me about a half an hour before I signed the document, and it was with a huge, heavy heart. And I've always wondered how we can protect the kids from this sort of trauma. So this might be a way. What happened then is it puts the burden on the jury, to look at other evidence, not just I've identified this person.
Yeah, Professor Weisberg, can you help us here?
Well, we haven't spoken of child IDs, and that's a much more complicated matter because, of course, there are so many complicated, you know, psychological factors that affect not just, obviously, the child's ability to identify someone, but the child's ability to testify about a traumatic matter at all. In fact, there is a whole body of law dealing with child testimony, even the possibility of not having the child actually appear in court, you know, to avoid the trauma of exposure like that. So I think we'd have to put that in a somewhat separate category because it's part of a much larger complex of issues about child witnesses.
Well, I've never heard before of a child having to sign a statement of that sort about 100% certainty.
No, and I'd have to ask my colleagues here, but I'd never heard of that, indeed, even with adult witnesses.
But Sally's call, of course, brings us back, Gary Wells, to just the uncertainty, whether it's a child or an adult. In fact, I'm looking at an email here. It's a story about a young woman who, along with her boyfriend, saw an accident, and they had completely different versions of what occurred. To this day, she says, I cannot be certain which of us was correct, but what I do know is that our stories about what we thought we saw could not have been more different. We agreed to disagree, and each of us recounted what we thought we had seen to the investigating officer. What I took away from this experience was a recognition that eyewitness testimony may be completely unreliable, even when delivered by two intelligent, earnest, well-intentioned people who witnessed an event that took place right in front of their noses.
Well, I think it speaks to the idea that, I mean, you know, eyewitness identification or eyewitness testimony is not totally unreliable, but it has to be used in conjunction with other kinds of evidence. In other words, generally speaking, there should be something that corroborates it. My guess is that with this, for example, with the caller's situation, is that, you know, there was an attempt. You know, I'm not saying that it was a malicious attempt, but rather an attempt to try to make the whole case rest on the witness. And the only way you can do that is for that witness to be 100% certain. That's really an unacceptable procedure. The uncertainty of the witness, witnesses should be allowed to express their uncertainty at the time of any identification. And then you're just going to have to, if that's not quite enough for a conviction, you're going to have to corroborate that with other kinds of evidence. And I think that's part of the problem. We've been trying to rely too much on just the identification and not other kinds of corroborating evidence.
Yeah, can I get you to put in here, Karen Sinanu-Towery?
Well, that's absolutely correct. I mean, the best cases are cases that don't rely on a sole witness, although, I mean, under the law, you can convict someone based on one witness's testimony. But the more serious the charge and the greater the consequences, the more likely you'll be able to find something that corroborates that eyewitness identification, whether it's clothing, the circumstances, the association the suspect has with a co-defendant, or as in the New Jersey case, you see there's actually a confession. So, you know, corroboration is very, very important. But I've never heard of a police agency asking for 100%. And here in Santa Clara County, that's why we ask the witnesses to say, how sure are you? And we have to accept, you know, their self-description of how certain they are.
Chris, one of the problems that may exacerbate all this is TV shows where there's an eyewitness and suddenly someone goes to trial and that eyewitness provides all the evidence that's necessary.
Well, the double blind is also so important because the officer who has investigated the case and knows who the suspect is, believes he knows who did it, that's based on investigation. He knows things that the witness doesn't know. And so it makes the officer give those little subtle hints or ask someone to sign something because the officer is 100% sure.
Yeah, but the officers don't like, as I said earlier, their integrity to be impeached on this score at all, generally, do they?
Fair enough.
Yeah. Now, let me get some more callers on here, and we'll go to John next. John, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I was identified by two people, a mother and a daughter, as burglarizing a car. I was arrested, and I took it to trial. And it was only my word against their word, and they were both positive I was the one that did it.
Did you do time as a result?
No. let out my own recognizance, but it took 8 months for it to go to trial. So for 8 months, that was hanging over my head. And then I was 8 days into a trial.
And they were convinced you were the one?
They were convinced. Yeah. Both of them, the mother and daughter. They said they saw me do it.
Okay, well, I thank you for that call. You hear a lot of those kinds of stories, alas, don't you, Gary Wells?
Yes, and, you know, and he actually introduces another sort of interesting angle on this, and that is that, you know, there were two witnesses, and they both identified him. But one of the interesting things that we sort of discovered really early in our experiments, and that is that, look, when witnesses make mistakes, they tend to make the same mistake. In other words, if one witness is going to misidentify somebody, then when you test the next witness who saw, they're going to tend to make the same mistake. Kirk Bloodsworth, one of the first DNA one of the early DNA exonerations in a murder case, had five witnesses who mistakenly identified him. And so just because more than one witness makes the identification, that does not mean that the identification is reliable necessarily. You know, if, for example, there's something suggestive about the identification procedure for every witness who goes through that procedure. So that's another kind of interesting angle, and that is that it's not just a problem necessarily with relying on one witness. I mean, even if there's multiple witnesses, you have to take a very careful look at how, you know, how they were tested. What's that lineup look like? What were the instructions, and so on?
The Innocence Project, Robert Weisberg, has to be brought in here in terms of sort of changing the whole nature and configuration of what we see, as well as a lot of the research by psychologist Elizabeth Loftus. I mean, at this point, she's out at UC Irvine. Those two elements have really changed the whole landscape, it seems to me.
Yes, they have, and they've interacted. The DNA phenomenon is more recent. There was obviously a fair amount of campaigning against eyewitness identification going back, several decades. But they've interacted because one of the great insights that Barry Sheck and Larry Marshall and Peter Neufeld and others from the DNA movement have offered us is not just to, isolate those cases where DNA exonerates the innocent, but to go back and look at the steps that led to the wrongful conviction or wrongful identification in the first place. In some cases, that was outright perjury or even malevolence by the police. But very often, it was fairly mundane factors like the unreliability of the ID.
Joe, you're our next caller on forum. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the
air. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
I had an experience 40 years ago. I was working the night shift at a liquor store. Just before closing, a gentleman walked in. He was an only customer. Very suspicious looking and just very nervous. He produced a sawed-off shotgun, stuck it in my face. I laid face down and went through the routine of getting held up at the store. I had a very clear image of his face, everything. Consequently, during the investigation, one of the detectives showed me a picture, recognized the picture. He goes on to say, well, you know, I think I know who this is. This has happened at various stores within the area. There are at least five other stores that have been hit. So, you know, I'll be following up with you if you see him again, something like that, give me a call. Time goes by, gives me a call and says, you know what, I picked the guy up. We picked him up on traffic warrants. Why don't you come on down? You know, there's going to be about 25 other people. Going to go through a lineup, you know, and it'll be really easy. He won't be able to see you, et cetera, et cetera. Go down. And I picked him out. I was quite certain. I did not know that none of the other didn't recognize the perpetrator. So consequently, I was the only positive eyewitness. And it was frustrating to me because the guy only served time for the traffic warrants and none of the armed robberies. That was an experience I'll never forget.
Mm. Well, thank you for relating it to your narrative. Appreciate hearing from you. And Karen Sinatari, the fact is that I know you've tried to do this integrity protocol, but So often, as I said, things happen quickly and people get confused and they're misled. And there's so many circumstances that contribute to misidentification. But also in the traditional kind of lineups, even when you're showing different photographs, you can have people who look alike. And that can be a problem. I mean, we've seen those tests that Professor Wells has done, just, you know, putting a look-alike in there and it making the world a difference. So talk about the selection process, just of how you do fillers and how you do all that.
Well, I think one of the most difficult things police do is the preparation of the photo lineup, because they have to make sure the backgrounds are the same. They have to make sure the all the photographs have similarities based on the witness's description. In other words, if the witness said the suspect had a mustache, everyone in the lineup better have a mustache, and they all better be the same race. And it is very difficult, because if they get to be too similar, you're not going to get a result. In other words, the witness is going to come down to two or three and go, well, I can't decide, and you really haven't accomplished anything. So it's certainly not an easy task. Prosecutors don't put those photo lineups together. The police do. I have observed live lineups, and for me, just the way I remember things, I think the live lineup is so much more satisfactory, because you can see the person three-dimensional and you can see their height and size. And to me, that's a much better way to do things. But those are becoming more and more rare because they're very time-consuming.
They're also, aren't they, Robert Weisberg, considered less reliable than just sitting down with photographs and going through them one by one?
Well, it depends on, you know, who's making the decision about reliability. We should probably defer to Dr. Wells on that. But I think it's true that the classic notion of the six-person lineup, is getting kind of obsolete. It simply can't be done with the flexibility of the photo lineup. I mean, Karen is certainly right that you see the three-dimensional, aspects of the people involved. On the other hand, you can't have as many possible faces or bodies as you would in a photo ID, and it's much more difficult to kind of to do them in the sequential way that's preferable, to go back and forth and so on and so on. So I think there's much more flexibility with the photo lineup, and obviously it can be cheaper in terms of police time.
Gary Wells, can we get you on this?
Yeah, I mean, all other things being equal, then the live lineup has a slight advantage. The problem is that in real practice, it's hard to make all other things equal. It's easier, as Karen was pointing out, the difficult part is finding the good fillers. You don't want people who are clones of your suspect. You want people who fit the description and so on. That's easier to do with photos than it is with a live lineup. I mean, sometimes you have a person who, as you go hit the streets or whatever to find your fillers for that, is just, very difficult to make it fair to the suspect in terms of having people who also fit that description well. The other problem that we're concerned about with regard to live lineups is that, a lineup, when properly constructed, there's one person who's a suspect. They know they're a suspect. And the other people are fillers, and they know they're fillers. And so the fillers are, pretty relaxed in that lineup. And the suspect, can at times look like, a deer caught in the headlights. So, but other things being equal, again, you want the three-dimensional, you want the body. That's a good thing to have. They're relatively uncommon now, except in places like New York. And New York has a peculiar situation where, by judicial law, the state, the prosecution cannot use photographic evidence of identity. They have to do a live lineup. Now, that doesn't mean they don't do photo lineups. They do. They do them all the time. But then they have to follow it up with a live lineup afterward.
Well, the other thing about a live lineup traditionally is they often ask the fillers as well as the suspect to speak in a certain voice and, you know, to say, I want your money or whatever, you know. At least that's the way it's often portrayed. And it always struck me as kind of ironic because there are people who could really just change their voice, you know, put it down a few octaves or up a few octaves. But let me get another caller on here. And that's Doug from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Thank you. About 25 years ago or so, I remember reading in, I believe it was Free Inquiry magazine, if that's still around, about some research on eyewitness identification. And shortly after that, I found myself in a jury pool. I believe it was an assault. I'm not sure. And when they asked, did I know of any reason why I wouldn't be qualified, this came into mind, and I started talking about eyewitness identification. And the prosecutor immediately cut me off and got me out of the courtroom. but I happen to think, you know, back in that day when the discovery rules were not as strict as they are now, you just wonder how many people, as we've heard on your show here, how many people have been wrongly convicted and how many people that were witnesses years later might have it in the back of their head that they put somebody in jail incorrectly. That's all I got.
All right. Thank you for that. I wonder, Karen Sinanotari, when you're going through jury selection, do you ask about how much credence a juror puts into eyewitness testimony? You ever get into that kind of specific?
Absolutely, we get into that, especially when it's a crucial factor. Well, and I will admit that 25 years ago, when I started in this business, there was a very strong belief among the court, the prosecutors, and police that eyewitness identification was the best. I mean, here we have someone here, and they say that guy did it. Could anything be better? And this, if you want to call it science, or these studies, have really changed our minds, and we're much more sophisticated in our thinking about that now. So I think what the caller experienced 25 years ago is accurate and wouldn't be found today. But we do definitely ask jurors before they're selected their opinions about this to see if they can be, if they're open-minded, closed-minded, and of course the defense is also interested in that answer.
And let me bring on Ken. Ken, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. Two quick questions. First off, how early should a witness, or what's the ideal time for a witness to be interviewed for you know, proper, the best recognition possible? And second, as my law professor used to say, the problem with our justice system is the prosecution cheats. We know that police still have a bias in convicting a certain defendant. The show is kind of dancing around that issue, and I see that these new, more modern techniques of witness identification with double blind sort of takes some of the bias out of it and gets around the whole convicting an innocent man problem. I'm particularly interested in my first point.
Well, let's take both your points. First, let me go to you, Gary Wells. You talked before about how memory is most accurate usually in a quick way. So what about the timing of witnesses?
In terms of giving them, in terms of interviewing them?
Yeah. That's what the caller asked for, yeah.
Getting reports as soon as possible,
yeah.
Absolutely. Memory does not get better with time. You want to do that as soon as possible. And now, with regard to identification, lineup, which would happen later once you have a suspect, you don't want to just rush into it. What you want to do is, because it's already been probably several days, sometimes weeks or months, what you want to do is make sure that the person that you're putting in this lineup is most likely the perpetrator, because the last thing you want to do is quickly pull together a lineup in which the real perpetrator is not in it, because then bad things happen. Witnesses pick fillers, which spoils the witness. Now you've got no witness, or they'll pick an innocent person. So, but in all other things being equal, you want to give you want to interview witnesses and basically get their statements as soon as possible.
Assistant District Attorney Sinanutauri, when the caller says prosecutors cheat, and that's a well-known fact, you say what?
He said his law professor said that. I hope it wasn't Bob Weisberg. Well, that's an unfortunate statement because we, you know, our duty is to, you know, convict the guilty and make sure that we don't pull someone innocent in. Mistakes have been made. That's a known fact. But there's nothing to benefit by us cheating. It's just not why we're in this business.
Well, Professor Weisberg, you want to comment?
There may have been cheating. Surely there has been cheating in American history, but that's not really the major problem, and it happens far less often than people think. I would add two things on that point. First, the police themselves can be subject to some of the biases in a kind of indirect way that witnesses are prey to. They may quite sincerely believe that an idea is correct and then fall into a kind of narrative pattern where they're reinforcing it without, you know, any dishonesty on their part. So they themselves, in effect, can be victims of some of these problematic circumstances. Another thing I should mention is that very often the suggestiveness doesn't come from the police anyway. It comes from third parties. In fact, the decision that your listeners may have heard about that will be coming down from the U.S. Supreme Court next year in a case called Perry versus New Hampshire is on a very specific issue, and that is, should the due process clause impose constraints on the use of procedures that are suggestive when the suggestions don't come from the police, in other words, when there isn't what lawyers call state action, but rather circumstances whereby third parties, private parties, may have influenced the witness in such a way as to distort the perspective.
Well, we will continue to monitor this, particularly, as I said earlier, because it's headed toward the Supreme Court, the whole idea of eyewitness identification, which has not been considered by the High Court since 1977. You can continue this discussion on our website just by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. I want to extend thanks to all of our guests, to Robert Weisberg, who's professor of law at Stanford and co-directs the Stanford Criminal Justice Center, and to Gary Wells, professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and to Karen Sinanutauri, assistant district attorney of Santa Clara County. Thanks to all of you. Thanks also to you, our listeners. We would not be here without you, and we want to thank our senior editor Dan Zoll and our producers Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And another hour of Forum is coming your way. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk with another Stanford law professor. Rick Banks is going to join us in studio to talk about his controversial book, in which he says black women are not marrying very often these days. The numbers are lower than other groups, and those numbers have to be brought up, or should be brought up. It will benefit everyone. That's his thesis. How? By marrying, as he says, out rather than up or down. We'll find out more about that in the hour ahead. I want to thank also our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.